For the week of March 7th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 44, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And outside the Kodak Theater, I'm Karen Woodward.
And picketing outside the Cablevision headquarters, I'm Michael Giltz.
Guys, could you just lower your voice just a bit? Do you really have to talk that loud? And can somebody please turn off that light?
Oh, what? Are you drunk?
What? Is this a joke?
Just a little, you know, I'm not going to lie. I may have a little bit of a hangover.
What did you do last night?
There was a little thing going on down here in Hollywood that I may or may not have indulged or imbibed a little too much at.
Okay, what Oscar party did you go to?
Wait, there was an Oscar party? Where?
I assumed you were there.
No, I was not at the Oscar party, but of course we will be talking the Oscar party as if there's just one. I was not at any Oscar parties, nor was I at the Oscars this year. However, we will be talking about them later during the episode. Michael has invited a very special guest.
That would be Damian Bona. Gosh, he is the co-author of Inside Oscar, which is the definitive account of the Oscars. It is literally the book that set the template for all the other awards books that have come in its wake. He wrote it in the first edition was in the late 70s, early 80s, and they've updated it three times. Back in the days before the internet, it was just, you know, essential. Plus, it was one of those rare award books that's actually fun to read. It has, you know, it did everything from start off with the campaigns and the movies of the year to the detailed analysis of the show itself. But it was very funny, not really bitchy, but it enjoyed the campiness and silliness of the Oscars and yet took it seriously by writing about it well. And it's just a great fun book. And he's a very good writer and has inspired many other writers in his wake. So I'm delighted he took the time to be with us.
Well, we will be giving Damian a call in just a moment to talk about the Oscars. We'll also talk a little bit about the Spirit Awards, a little bit about Cablevision, as Michael kind of alluded to in his intro, and a number of big deal or big whoop stories. And so that's just a little tease. But first, as always, we will talk about the North American box office. And I guess we have to talk about the North American box office until we can talk about the global box office. There is no way to get the global box office religiously. So, Michael, take it away.
Well, the torch was passed this weekend from Avatar, which has dropped to number 5. And despite a few hit movies like Shutter Island, Avatar to Alice in Wonderland, the first big 3D film of 2010, it grossed a remarkable $116 million over the weekend. I think it was $220 million worldwide, something like that, or $210 million
yes.
Worldwide. It was just way beyond everyone's projections, though I don't know why, because Tim Burton has set records before. He set opening weekend box office records with Batman and Batman Returns. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, but a massive hit for him and Johnny Depp. It just dominated the box office like nothing else. Number 2, way in the back in the pack, was Brooklyn's Finest, a drama with Bruce Willis. Number 3 was Martin Scorsese.
No. Bruce Willis was not in Brooklyn's Finest.
Oh,
it was Richard Gere.
I'm sorry. Brooklyn's Finest was Bruce Willis in Cop Out. Who is in Brooklyn's Finest?
Ethan Hawke. Isn't it Ethan Hawke?
No, it's Richard Gere.
Ethan Hawke is in it and Richard Gere. They're both in it. None of us saw it.
Number clearly, where we forgot about it immediately.
You know, the movie premiered at Sundance 2009, so I saw it like ages ago.
Oh, you did see it. Well, it's from the director of Training Day, so Ethan Hawke is in it. And it got okay reviews, didn't get savage, and it made $13.5 million, a good opening for a movie that didn't cost a lot. And it's from the people who put out The Crazies, which is also a modestly budgeted movie that's doing pretty well. So, you know, it was a good launch, especially next to Alice in Wonderland. Number 3 is the Martin Scorsese film Shutter Island. It grossed $13.3 million. It's just below $100 million. It'll be the third hit of his career to hit $100 million. Suddenly out of nowhere, he's making hit movies. Number 4 was Cop Out, the Kevin Smith film with Bruce Willis and Tracy Morgan. It's at $32 million, which makes it the biggest Kevin Smith hit of all time. And at number 5 was Avatar, which grossed $7.7 million. All of its screens were taken away by Alice in Wonderland. It collapsed 43%. It's grossed $720 million. And soon, Karen, we won't have to talk about it ever again until the DVD release. Did anyone see Alice in Wonderland? I did.
I did not.
I mean, I've seen so many clips from it. And, you know, being in the industry that I work in, motion picture exhibition and distribution, you know, I've seen extended clips, and as they were working on the 3D, the 2D to 3D conversion, but I just did not have time this weekend with the Oscars and the Spirit Awards and the, you know, just living life.
I'll take that as a no.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
It was not bad. It's my favorite Tim Burton film in a while because I haven't liked most of his movies. I don't think he's a very good filmmaker. But Johnny Depp was fun.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, no, he every time he makes a movie, you think, wow, that's a perfect pairing of director and film, Sweeney Todd, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And then you actually see the film and it's not very good. This one isn't great either, but it's pretty good. And Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter have a lot of fun in their roles. So it's painless. It turns Alice in Wonderland into sort of an action film. But and that's really one of the great books of all time. But it's not bad.
It did not receive very good reviews. However, it did make a mint. Around 70% or over $80 million of Alice in Wonderland's opening gross in North America came from 3D screens, and it set a record for IMAX, grossing an estimated $11.9 million on 188 screens, which beats out the previous benchmark for that IMAX title, Avatar, at $9.5 million, which opened in December on 178 screens. Okay, well.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, and how many of those people do you think went to it specifically because it was 3D? I would say zero.
Well,
they went because it was Johnny Depp and Tim Burton and Alice in Wonderland, and they would have gone anyway. And it was not a hit because it was in 3D.
That very well may be true, but what Hollywood is looking at is the fact that 3D made it earn an additional $22 million.
Yeah, people are suckers.
But no, it didn't.
People
they charged
suckers.
A higher price
for it. Yeah,
because
3D is more expensive.
Yes, yeah, the tickets that they didn't earn money because it was 3D any more than movies earn money because they're color. I did not go to it because it was 3D. I was annoyed that I had to pay an extra $3, but I was not. That's not why I was there.
I don't think that's what Sperling's saying. I think he's pointing out that it made a lot of money, and part of that is because 3D movies charge more.
Correct,
but they're putting the cart before the horse. They were able to charge a premium for the movie, just like they have been for IMAX for a while, but. You know, IMAX at least offers something of bonus. I would say the IMAX is more arguable because people, you know, looked at those screens and said, yes, we want to see it in IMAX when it's not made for IMAX. That to me is a bonus, but they're just jacking up the ticket prices.
Well, I think it's too early really to be able to tell how 3D is going to affect moviegoers and ticket prices. It's going to be an interesting thing to follow.
And you know, Michael, I would say that I don't think there were carts or horses in Alice in Wonderland.
Actually, there were.
Okay, I didn't see it. But
we should get to the Oscars because
that's
nothing
true.
Matters more than the Oscars, even though tomorrow we won't remember what won Best Picture.
Well, we can, of course, start off by saying that Avatar didn't. But before we get Damien on the phone, Avatar suffered its biggest decline yet. It was down 44%. Of course, it still made, you know, over $7 million, $7.7 million. Blindside finally surpassed $250 million. It made an additional $1.3 million. It's the highest grossing sports movie ever. And Crazy Heart got a little boost from the Oscars. It was up 36%. Of course, it also went a little wider on 126 more screens.
Yeah, Crazy Heart is the only movie to benefit from the Oscar nominations.
And rightfully so. I think it's a great movie.
That song is amazing.
I don't love it as much as you guys, but I think he's good in it, and I'm thrilled for the movie. It's made $30 million, and it'll get a little jump now, and it'll be up. It could hit $40 million, $45 million. Who knows?
For a $7 million movie, that's not bad.
That almost went straight to country music television debut.
Fox Searchlight really knows what they're doing. I think they're one of the most impressive mini studios in town. Impressive studios, period.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we get Damien on the phone? You've already introduced him, so I'll just dial him up here as you guys talk amongst yourselves.
How psyched were we that Avatar didn't get anything last night?
Don't give everything away.
I've already seen it.
Hi, Damien.
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us, Damien. Of course, you're joining us here to talk about last night's Oscar Awards, the 82nd annual Oscar Awards. What did you think overall of the awards?
I think the show itself is very bland. It was almost like a redux of Gilbert Cates, and that it's almost as if they just swept away any of the innovations from last year and, you know, just went back to form. It was a dull evening, and unfortunately, Steve Martin, who was brilliant in the past, I think just seemed to be relying on shtick, and I don't think having two hosts worked.
It did seem a little odd. I mean, even the camera shots seemed like they didn't really even know how to frame them very well, because some people have 16:9, widescreen HD televisions. Some people are on standard definition, kind of 133 televisions, so they're more square, and they didn't really know how to frame them.
The whole thing just sort of seemed thrown together without much thought.
It was 20% higher in the ratings than last year. It jumped up to 27.4 rating, which I think will be about 43 million viewers. We'll get that figures in an hour or two. I've read a lot of the reviews, the New York Times, LA Times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter. I think it was Variety had the best line. They said the show played like a team protecting a big lead. They played it very safe. But what I haven't read is a reference to how incompetent it was technically. We've sort of mentioned it a little bit, but there were open mics on the entire night. You heard a burbling sound in the background. You heard noises in the back throughout the entire show. I kept calling people in other parts of the country saying, are you hearing this? And they're like, yeah, I can hear that too. I thought it might have been my TV. But it was really, they would, I mean, when Catherine Bigelow won her award, they cut away from her when she had the moment with her husband, James Cameron. They cut to this shot way up in the balcony.
That would be ex-husband.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, we all know that. But it was just bizarrely incompetent on a technical level, I thought. What did you think, Damien?
Sometimes they would cut to someone in the audience for a reaction shot, and there would be no lighting on them, so you'd see somebody in the shadows. It was odd. Adam Shankman, an hour before the show started, was out on the red carpet talking to E, so, you know, where he should have been, you know, checking all his last minute technical aspects.
Well, and we should say that Adam Shankman was one of the directors of the Oscars.
That's right. And he's a co-host, producer, and he's a co-host of So You Think You Can Dance, a judge, I should say, on So You Think You Can Dance.
And he's a film director. Show. I mean, and he clearly likes the spotlight.
And of course, that brings up the best moment of the show, which of course means the worst moment of the show, which is, of course, the dance number for the film score tribute.
Well, it was as if they had brought back Debbie Allen.
Exactly. I thought she was banned for life.
I thought we, you know, were done for good with those awful... ballet interpretation numbers. For a production number to work, it has to be kind of a old showbiz kind of a dance number. Ballet just does not play well on the TV screen. I'm sure it was much more impressive in the theater, but on TV it just didn't work at all.
Yeah, I think interpretive dance is the new black.
You know, I feel like I saw a completely different Oscars. I really enjoyed this show. I thought that it moved along at a quick pace. It didn't bother me that there weren't a lot of upsets. I thought that the people who we knew were going to win clearly had their speeches together. I thought that the strange camera angles were actually rather amusing. I liked that the open mics, which I don't think were quite as obvious when watching it in L.A., was kind of funny because you could hear people talking off mic.
Yes.
That's not a sign of a well-run show, though.
But I enjoyed it. I frankly don't care quite as much if it's a well-run show as I do whether me as somebody watching it enjoyed it. And I did. I thought that the hosts were funny. I thought two hosts totally worked. The only things that really irked me were those damn lamps. Did you see lamps
Oh,
everywhere?
My God.
Why was that the theme of the night?
Yeah, they kept lowering that set design of lampshades. Any interpretation of what that might mean, Damien?
I have no idea. And not only on stage, but on the railings in the auditorium itself.
Yeah, like people really? On people's shoulders, like they were sitting in a hotel lobby. That's strange.
Well, the only thing that I liked about the show was a small change that I've been pushing for years, was that when they announced the technical awards, instead of naming the people first, they say Avatar wins by Joe Schlomo, Susan Schlomplom, and Bobby Hoopoo. Because when they say the names of the people first, we have no idea what movie won. But this year they reversed the order and they would name the movie before the tech awards. Was there anything you liked about this show, Damien?
I like that part. I didn't like, however, that they reverted to... And the winner is, for the last 20 years, it had been in the Oscar goes to not make it seem so much like a win-lose situation. But Adam Shankman just thought, you know, it was better. And, you know, in terms, He said he wanted to make it like the ultimate reality show, and so you had to have a winner. And, you know, the beginning where he had the 10 lead acting nominees on stage, that was sort of his American Idol moment. You know, ladies and gentlemen, these are the contestants. It was all pretty tacky.
Well, yeah, and there was, speaking of reality shows, there was that moment there when they did the John Hughes tribute that all of John Hughes' Brat Pack folks, Matthew Broderick, Molly Ringwald, Judd Nelson, who looked just...
Are we sure that was Judd Nelson?
Unbelievably.
That was creepy.
Yeah, I think that was a little odd. Among others, John Cryer. They all kind of came out, and I thought to myself, wow, it's Dancing with the Stars.
Well, that was everyone but Emilio Estevez from The Breakfast Club. I'm not sure why he wasn't there. But I timed it. That was 6 minutes long. Damien, you should know better than I. I can't recall any dead person getting such a long tribute in the show. I mean, Orson Welles, Katharine Hepburn, has anyone ever gotten this long a tribute just for dying?
I don't think so. You know, I said to a friend of mine who's like more of a literary person who likes movies more than a cinephile, I said, well, this year they're doing a tribute to a director who died recently. And he said, oh, great, I can't wait to see the Eric Rohmer tribute.
Yeah, who of course passed away, a French director who passed away.
So, I mean, it's absurd. I mean, those clips just reminded you how lousy those movies are.
Oh, I disagree. Clips reminded me of how fantastic they were.
No.
And that they don't age. I can still watch those movies and enjoy them. It's the same things that we went through.
You must have been 16 years old in the 80s.
I think she was.
I was 16 years old in the 80s.
But so was I, but they still looked dated.
That's why, you know, I would like a tribute to Leave It to Beaver. So it's a generation thing. But on an objective level, those movies are crap.
What I found very interesting is that John Hughes was never nominated for... Well, I don't know if he was never nominated.
It's not interesting. It's not a surprise at all.
No, he never nominated. Nobody would have even thought of nominating him.
Do you think Home Alone was dissed at the Oscars?
No. What I find interesting...
Well, it was nominated for Best Song.
Yes, but John Hughes never won an Oscar, and yet they spend 6 minutes paying tribute to a guy they never honored while he was alive.
Which was insane. It was ridiculous. And there's never been an artist in the history of Hollywood, not Charlie Chaplin, not John Wayne, not Orson Welles, not Katharine Hepburn. No one has ever gotten the tribute that they decided they need to fill the show with for 6 minutes of the Oscars.
Adam Shankman must have had a Jones for John Hughes because he was born in 64, so would have made him in his 20s. So it was, even with him, it's arrested development because should have been too old for those movies.
Well, why don't we go over some of the winners, starting with some of the categories that probably ticked people off, because these were the categories that made you win or lose your Oscar pool. Best Documentary Short Subject went to Music by Prudence. Now, I don't think last week during our prediction show we even picked a winner there.
Well, Damien and I both picked that for the winner. I did, thanks to Damien's recommendation.
Right, you just had to look at the synopsis and you knew that was a winner.
Well, and what was the deal with the woman who won that award with the gentleman there?
She's physically deformed.
No, I'm talking about
the one on stage.
Yes.
Oh. The one who, like, crashed.
She's mentally deformed.
The Oscars.
Presumably she was drunk, but I don't know. That was one of the odder Oscar moments. It was like a Kanye West moment.
It was. I mean, the gentleman, the filmmaker, was giving his speech, and this woman comes out of nowhere and says, "Move out of the way. Let a woman talk."
She managed to ruin both their moments, too, with her stepping on his line, because she was incoherent. And he was doing fine, so it was a shame.
Apparently, she was a co-producer who left the project over creative differences. But
really?
I just read that this morning.
Okay. Oh, that's
awesome.
She should
never have been up there in the first place?
No, she belonged there. She was credited, but she had argued with him over the direction of the film.
She belonged up there, but, you know, she that didn't give her any license to be rude.
Wow.
Short film live action went to The New Tenants, and I think we didn't pick... Well, actually...
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. Ann Thompson did.
Ann Thompson picked The Door, which did not win.
Somebody picked The New Tenants because, Michael, you were saying about how much you just couldn't stand that movie.
Right, but it was the one with the Hollywood recognizable actors in it, so that was the one I... it doesn't say much to say, you know, what two movies it comes down to. I thought it was down to instead of Abracadabra and The New Tenants. And unfortunately, The New Tenants won. But that's where you make your Oscar picks, especially this year. Isn't that right, Damien? Because so many of the top categories were pretty predictable, especially the acting categories.
Yes, I was hoping that for an upset in supporting actor, first of all, because Christoph Waltz gives such boring acceptance speeches. And I just have to say, I don't get the acclaim for that performance, which to me seems all over the place.
Who did you want to win?
I would have liked to have seen Woody Harrelson win.
Oh, that he did. He gave a great
career award for Christopher Plummer.
Well, certainly both were deserving, and I thought that Woody Harrelson gave a great performance in The Messenger, and I guess we should skip ahead to Best Supporting Actor. Christoph Waltz for Inglourious Basterds did win. I think we all had that, including Anne Thompson from IndieWire and Eric Childress from eFilm Critic, who joined us last week to do our predictions.
Well, everyone had Christoph Waltz, Monique, and Jeff Bridges. The only question was who would win Best Actress, and Sandra Bullock was the front runner. Damon, was there any... You had picked her as well as being just the one who had played the game the best and was just poised to take it all.
Although in the course of the evening when Precious won Best Screenplay instead of the expected Up in the Air, you know, there was some thought, well, you know, maybe there could be a Best Actress upset as well with KB. But, you know, Sandra Bullock, it was just her year. Everyone loves her. She's sweet. She's self-deprecating. She gave a very nice speech. You know, Meryl seems fine with, you know, just going every year and not getting on stage.
Oh.
But yeah, I mean, Sandra Bullock, she won Best Actress in a Leading Role for The Blind Side. And when she won, she kind of leaned over as if she was going to kiss Meryl Streep. And she alluded to it several times. But I wondered how many people actually knew that she won.
What she was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, she won the SAG Award with Meryl Streep, and they kissed on stage, and it was a big moment. But how many people had actually seen the SAG Awards?
Well, it was carried in clips the next day.
Okay.
I didn't see it, but, you know, I was aware of it. So, I mean, I think she milked that joke a little too much, but that's fine.
Well, now, we gave away some of the other winners. Jeff Bridges won Best Actor in a Leading Role for Crazy Heart, beating out George Clooney, Colin Firth, Morgan Freeman, and Jeremy Renner. Christoph Waltz, we already mentioned, for Best Actress in a Supporting Role, surprising nobody. Monique for Precious won.
And surprising nobody.
Surprising nobody. And you mentioned adapted screenplay. Now, what we had picked was Up in the Air for Best Adapted Screenplay, which would have given Jason Reitman's and Sheldon Turner an Academy Award, and they won several other awards during this season for that script, but instead, Precious won.
Everyone assumed Up in the Air would win because it's such a smart, intelligent script. You know, Precious was based on a novel that's kind of free-floating and elliptical. And I, you know, never underestimate the power of liberal humanism with the Academy.
Well, and of course, the Oscars made history this year. For the very first time, a woman won Best Director. Every year, it seems that some history is made in some way. I mean, an African-American man was nominated for Best Director, and he could have won, and it was a woman this time. When Barbara Streisand said, "The time has finally come," I imagine Lee Daniels sort of getting out of his seat,
like,
and going, "Oh,
yeah,
wait,
it's mine, it's my woman. Time.
I thought that moment there with Barbara Streisand was kind of, she had to do that. She had to say that give that pregnant pause when she opened the envelope, and she had to have her little moment where she said, you know, the time has finally come, and then waited a moment before immediately saying Kathryn Bigelow's name. And it just, it was anticlimactic then. I did not like that.
You know, kind of self-aggrandizing, saying, it's implying that I should have won for the Prince of Tides, but, you know, finally you made up for that. And, you know, obviously everyone knew that she was rooting for Kathryn Bigelow, so she really didn't have to say anything to emphasize it.
And I don't think they ever cut away to James Cameron, did they?
They didn't have to. He was sitting right behind his ex-wife.
Yeah, but they didn't show her. They didn't show her and him when she won. Did she turn around and hug him?
I don't
him
know. They didn't have a moment. That was why I.
They did I, not have I, a moment. She just got
walked
been, up.
That would have been a great thing to show. Show her, keep her back to him, and walk up to the stage.
But I thought that was It was a poor choice, I thought, to have him sitting behind her. They couldn't find any other place for him.
I agree with that.
But they get along. They get along well. What's wrong with that?
It was disrespectful. Neither one of them should have been sitting behind the other.
But people sit near each other all the time.
But one behind the other, I think, is what Terrence did.
Yeah, and I know what you're saying, Michael, but it still felt rather disrespectful. Damien, what did you think of Catherine's speech?
Dreadful.
I thought it was bland. You know, if ever there was a time to make a political speech, that was it. You know, whether it was about the war or whether it was about women's place in the industry. But, you know, instead it was just a, you know, bland rah-rah, support the troops kind of thing.
Go hazmat, people. Go hazmat,
people. I thought she was going to faint. I thought she was going to faint.
It was a really bad speech.
It was like an ingenue who didn't think she was going to win. And she gets up there and she's breathy and, frankly, a little vapid. I was extremely disappointed.
To be honest, there were really no memorable speeches last night.
No.
I mean, I like Monique saying, you know, sort of saying, you know, the hell with you, David Wells.
Exactly.
Or Jeffrey Wells.
Yeah.
David Wells in a piece said that she should be punished for refusing to campaign and nobody should give her the Oscar, which I felt ridiculous. It's like if someone campaigns well, fine, that's a good thing to mention, like Sandra Bullock. But the idea that you should not vote for someone because they didn't work the party circuit is obnoxious and ridiculous.
So we're talking about Jeffrey Wells, right? Let's just make sure we...
Jeffrey Wells.
Okay, yeah, because she got up there and the first thing she said was, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here.
It's about the performance, not the publicity.
Politics.
Politics. And I think that because she used that word politics, I wonder if a lot of people were like, well, what's she talking about?
I think everybody in the room knew what she was talking about.
Everybody in the room. I'm talking about everybody watching the television set.
Who cares about the whole – that's why they listened to our show.
They were all looking at her dress. They didn't care.
That's why they listened to our show, to find out what she was meant.
Exactly. I like Jeff Bridges' speech and Sandra Bullock's.
Jeff Bridges went on way too long. Sandra Bullock's, I thought, was pretty good. Damien?
So, you know, it was really nice when she, you know, gave a shout out to her mother who taught her not to be prejudiced. So,
yeah.
seeing that she grew up in the 70s, I doubt that her mother told her, you know, mentioned sexual orientation as something not to be prejudiced against.
I don't know. They were artists, you know, and they moved around a lot.
It could have been cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, Jeff Bridges, you know, he gives these kind of rambling, shambly speeches, but you know, it's who he is. His speech was kind of sweet.
You know, I guess during the Spirit Awards, people were wondering whether he was high or not. And I guess one could ask the same question watching him on the Oscars. A speech that seemed to just fall flat on its face was Jeffrey Fletcher, who, like everybody in the room and everybody watching, did not think he would win the screenplay for win the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay, which he won for Precious. He didn't seem to know what to say.
He could have jotted down some notes just in case.
I know, for Pete's sake.
He also didn't seem to know how to speak in public. There were like these picturesque pauses between each word.
I know, he sounded like Michael Jackson, right?
Just with a deeper voice.
No, not really.
And of course, every year, you know, when you look back on the awards, it makes sense. The Hurt Locker won Best Picture. And so, of course, it won in most of the categories that it was nominated in. I've looked back. It's the lowest grossing Oscar winner since The Apartment in 1960. And I think if you look at the Oscar winners of Best Picture, they're almost always successes. They're commercial hits, even relative to whatever their budget was, like Chariots of Fire. But they're really hits. I mean, you have to really look hard to find a movie. As far as I can tell, this looks like the biggest flop to win Best Picture.
It's not a flop. I don't know why you're obsessed with this movie's number.
This movie grossed $14 million. It cost $11 million to make. It grossed $18 million worldwide. That is not a success. It is the closest to a flop since Marty, which I could not find any box office figures on back in the 50s. I mean, this movie is really unusual for the Oscars. There have been lots of indie films that have won, like Crash or Chariots of Fire or even Last Emperor, which made a lot of money overseas. But Damien, as far as I can tell, this is the least commercially successful film in 50, 60 years, if not ever.
Well, that's why a lot of us going into award season thought it wasn't going to win. Just because the Academy tends to, reflect popular taste more than the taste of critics. But, you know, it was when it started winning all the Guild Awards that it sort of became the front runner. Usually The Last Emperor was cited as the least popular movie to win Best Picture. But as you say, that did do well overseas. You know, this, you know, it's a typical Iraq war movie in that nobody wanted to see it.
You know, just to put it into some perspective, during the Barbara Walters special, which aired after the awards here on the West Coast and before the awards on the East Coast, the trailer for Iron Man 2 that was premiered and shown during that special, more people saw that promo and that trailer than saw The Hurt Locker. So that's you know, just putting it in some perspective there. And Michael, you did say that if The Hurt Locker started to win some of the technical awards like sound editing and sound mixing, which it did win, that you could really look for that film to run away with the night, and it won six awards.
That's when I realized
awards.
It was going to sweep and probably take Best Picture.
Yeah, so it was the first time that the sound awards were really the giveaway.
Because usually they're for the techie sci-fi movie.
Whatever you think about Avatar, I mean, one has to admit it probably should have won the sound awards just because, you know, there's it's such a technical advancement.
Let's talk about what Avatar did win. It won art direction for Rick Carter and Robert Stromberg and Kim Sinclair. Now, Karen, that was the award we had all pegged, but you said you thought that was the only award it should win. But it also won for cinematography, Mauro Fiori, who, you know, I guess used those special first-of-their-kind cameras, those 3D cameras to shoot the film, beat out The White Ribbon and beat out The Hurt Locker. And it also won a little category that nobody really expected. Oh, no, actually they did. Visual effects. Joe Letteri, Steven Rosenbaum, Richard Bainham, and Andrew R. Jones won best visual effects for Avatar. So those were it. That was it. Three technical awards and out.
Well, I mean, no one, you know, thought of it as great storytelling in terms of narrative or dialogue. So it was, you know, it was clearly a technical achievement rather than, you know, an intellectual achievement. But, you know, I would have thought it might have done a little bit better. And I think there's still, you know, until you heard the winners of the Sound Award, there was a possibility that Bigelow would have gotten director and Avatar would have gotten Best Picture, because there are years where, you know, they sort of split it between a big production for Best Picture and then a smaller, more cerebral film for Best Director, Best Screenplay.
But looking at the history of the Oscars, this is before this year, only three films in history had even been nominated for Best Picture that were sci-fi movies, and that is A Clockwork Orange, Star Wars, and E.T., none of which won. And then this year, thanks to the list of top 10, we got two more movies. We got Avatar and District 9. So it really is unbelievably unusual even to be nominated. I mean, throughout all of Oscar history, only five sci-fi movies have even been nominated for Best Picture.
Well, they tend to be B-movies, but, I mean, 2001 wasn't even nominated, though Kubrick was nominated for Best Director. You know, I guess people back in 1968 just didn't really get 2001. It was, you know, the kids who were smoking grass at the time who really made that a cold.
Well, just to go over a few of the other winners really quickly, for original screenplay, Mark Boll won for The Hurt Locker. For makeup, Star Trek won. Logorama won for Best Animated Short. So, Michael, good on you. We all thought it was going to be Nick Park for his latest Wallace and Gromit entry, but he did not win a third Academy Award. Instead, it went to Nicholas Schmerkin for Logorama. The original song, as everybody had predicted, went to Crazy Heart for The Weary Kind.
This time, Ryan Bingham was not in the bar like he was for the Golden Globes.
Right. Ryan Bingham and T-Bone Burnett accepted the award. And one of the more poignant speeches and the speeches that I liked, my good friend Michael Giacchino, who won Best Original Score for Up, I thought his speech was pretty good.
I don't even remember him.
I don't remember it either.
Oh, it's where it's basically when he said that
he said, "Kids, be inspired and keep your dream alive. You're not wasting your time." Oh no, that's Dexter.
Oh yeah, that was very sweet.
That basically he said, you know, that when he grew up, he borrowed his father's movie camera and he was very creative and with it. He tried to be as creative as he possibly could, and never, not once, did anybody ever tell him he was wasting his time. And, you know, this is a guy I worked with. He was basically an administrative assistant at Disney when I worked with him. And now he's standing on the Academy Awards stage accepting an Oscar. I think that's pretty great.
Yeah, that was a nice speech.
Well, foreign language film, just to wrap up some of the winners here, The Secret in Their Eyes, El Secreto de Sus Ojos, one Argentinian film. I had picked The White Ribbon. A couple of us had picked The White Ribbon. I know that Ann Thompson had picked, she really liked the Argentinian film.
Well, both Damien and I had the Argentinian film as well.
Ah, okay.
It seemed like, I mean, I hadn't seen it, but from the description, it seemed like the most sort of traditional humanistic type foreign film, which is basically what they go through. I think The White Ribbon is too ambiguous for them. The movie from Peru featured a potato and a vagina, which
and A Prophet was just too darn good. It was one of my favorite films of last year. My favorite film of last year. So that obviously was just too cool for them to enjoy.
I think we just found our title, by the way.
A potato and a vagina. Yeah. And of course, the big omission of the Oscars, beyond all the technical mishaps, was in the obits. They always seem to miss someone. This year, they missed Farrah Fawcett. Do you think she should have been in there? Was she enough of a movie star to be in there?
She was really a television star, not a movie star.
B. Arthur died. Yeah, but Farrah Fawcett was in The Apostle, Oscar nominated or winning film. And she was in Extremities, another film that had Oscar talk. Was she enough of a star to be there, Damien, or was that not an omission?
I always say, you know, err on the side of having too many people rather than not enough. I mean, it wasn't as egregious as a few years ago when they didn't include Dorothy Malone. Dorothy McGuire, you know, who was a major star in the 40s and 50s and an Oscar nominee. But, you know, there was no reason not to include her.
Well, if they included Michael Jackson, they sure as heck could have included Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, the final award that I think we did not cover was... Actually, no, we have two. Documentary feature did not go to Food, Inc. or Burma VJ.
You picked The Cove, Damon. I picked The Cove.
Yes, The Cove, and I believe everybody except me and Karen picked The Cove. So that one... hey, guess what? Fisher Stevens is now an Academy Award winner, so go figure.
And Michelle Pfeiffer was in the room also.
I know. I actually thought about that when he got up there.
Yeah, but that was so long ago, though, you know.
He's got to be the biggest loser of all time. I mean, a geek like that who got Michelle Pfeiffer and then...
loses her.
lost her because he cheated on her, not vice versa.
Truly pathetic.
Does anybody know what Sean Penn was referencing when he's... gave his rambling intro to Best Actress where he said something like, Oscar and I have...
Forgot to thank an actress or something?
Oscar and I have something in common because we forgot people or, yeah.
I thought maybe he was referring his soon-to-be ex-wife.
Damien, any ideas?
I didn't know what he was talking about.
Does anybody ever know what Sean Penn is talking about?
Yes.
I like Sean Penn.
I'm just wondering. Okay, the final category that we did not go over was the one where could they have put this person further away from the stage for costume design. The young Victoria Sandy Powell wins her third Oscar, and she looked pretty darn good.
Oh, she was one of the worst speeches of the night. It was sort
Wait,
of
who?
Obnoxious.
I'm sorry, I missed. Who's?
Sandy Powell.
Sandy Powell for Best Costume Design. Which
I loved it.
Oh, it was. I already have two of these. So here's for the little people who never got one.
Yeah, but I'm taking this one home.
Yeah, I hate when people... accept and remind the audience that, you know, I've been up here before. But at the same time, after she did that, the fact that she did at least bring attention to people who do contemporary design, who always get the short shrift, you know, that was kind of a nice gesture. One thing we didn't mention was adapted or original screenplay, because I think most people thought Quentin Tarantino was going to win for Inglourious Basterds. You know, I was delighted we didn't have to endure another speech from him.
No, Mark Boll won for the Hurt Locker, and he gave a very good speech.
Well, Damien, there's we're just about done here, but I know you're also a member of the only other award show that matters, and that is the IRAs, a rather mysterious organization that's been around since the 70s, I believe, and giving out awards with people in the industry, including Oscar winners, I might add, have been members of the IRAs. I'm wondering if you have any indication of the IRA award show, which is next weekend, any ideas of what might win Best Picture this year at the IRAs?
Well, there seems to be a lot of support for Hunger, the Irish movie about Bobby Sands, but I'm going to be in there fighting for Summer Hours. I don't think you're going to see many of the Oscar nominees having much part at the IRAs.
Monique should not bother to show up.
She can come over and campaign, but I don't think even that would help her.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. I know we appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. And God bless.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was nice of Damon to stop by. He kept his comments G-rated, I should say, for our podcast audience. He can be a lot sharper tongued when you're talking to him in person. But I appreciate him talking to us about the Oscars. And, of course, his book, Inside Oscar, which he co-wrote with the late Damon Wiley, is available at fine bookstores everywhere.
Well, and what were the high points for you?
Okay, I liked Sandra Bullock winning. I liked, I loved Tina Fey and Robert Downey Jr.'s.
That was funny.
Announcing whatever screenplay they announced adapted. Those are probably my two favorites.
Michael?
For me, it was the interpretive dance. I always watch the Oscars for some train wreck of a moment, and that was it.
And who looked the best?
Sarah Jessica Parker.
No, my God, are you kidding me? That dress was horrible, and her hair was horrible.
Gorgeous, so gorgeous.
Oh, she looked horrible. All I've heard is bad reviews. You're
stunning.
All alone. You're all alone. Really?
I like Sandra Bullock, I'm not a big fan of hers, but she actually looked pretty good.
She did look good.
I hit on her, but her husband pushed me aside.
Are you serious?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, my God.
And Karen, you said that this was it felt fast-paced. It was 3 hours and 37 minutes.
Horrible, horrible. There was so much filler. It was ridiculous.
The horror movie tribute. What was filler besides your favorite interpretive dance?
The horror movie tribute.
Yeah, that was weird, right?
6 minutes to John Hughes. It was ridiculous. There was so much wasted space and time on that show. It was terrible.
This easily could have been 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Easily, yeah. They did a bad job. It was sloppily directed, bad audio, badly done, bad choices, tons of filler. It was incredibly poorly paced.
They had one camera moment, which I absolutely loved, and that was when it was like somebody hiding behind Meryl Streep. Did you have that on your coast?
No, I missed that.
It was like we were sitting like on her shoulder. I was like, what the hell's going on? By the way, Sperling, who did she come with? Who was that? Her publicist?
Meryl Streep? Wasn't it someone from her family?
No, it wasn't her husband.
Or one of her kids? No, she usually brings her kids. One kid. I guess she's run out of people to bring.
No, it was definitely an older man, but definitely was not her husband.
16 years, she's run out of friends.
Yeah, I know, right? I want to say it was, like a Howard Bragman or somebody like that. I think it was, a big-time agent or a big-time publicist or somebody that, is above our level of Sperling, so, we don't know them. I saw so many publicists on the red carpet. I'm like, oh, hey, it's so-and-so. It's so-and-so. It's so weird.
Well, I would have to say for me, the high point of the show came just a couple of seconds in. Neil Patrick Harris's little opening was really good. They should just get him to host the Oscars.
They will someday.
I think he fired his agent, though, he said in his little song.
That was a joke. If I could say one more thing about the Oscars, text Dolphin to 44144. Text Dolphin to 44144.
Was that a Cove thing?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the sign he was holding up. I haven't done it yet because I was afraid it might cost money. But
oh, no. Are you serious?
Yeah. He held that up that's the guy who helped create the TV show Flipper and had Flipper committed, according to him in the Covey, describes Flipper committing suicide because he was so depressed about being caged. Flipper literally came into his arms, looked in his eyes, and chose to stop breathing, which dolphins can do. They have to choose to breathe every single breath. They're not automatic breathers. So Flipper committed suicide in his arms. The next day, he went over to the aquarium in Miami and tried to free dolphins and got arrested for it. And he spent the last 40 years of his life trying to free dolphins and end the slaughter of dolphins. So it was, he takes this very, very seriously indeed. He became rich off of the imprisonment of dolphins, and he's been trying to make up for it ever since.
Well, and he had 43.5 million viewers to campaign to yesterday.
Exactly.
Well, I know, Karen, you have got to go.
No.
Oh, you're so sweet.
I'm just kicking her off. I just can't stand her anymore.
No, I'm having one of those weeks where it's like, I don't know how I have enough hours to do everything I need.
I know you've got an important client meeting right now. So, you know,
Did you like the Modern Family TV commercial?
Yeah, that was really funny.
I thought I did too.
Very clever.
And I know you both liked Parenthood. I saw your tweets.
No, I
liked it. Michael didn't like it.
Oh, no, okay. No, I thought it was a good cast, but I thought the ads were brilliant. They made the show look much better than it was.
Give it a break. We'll talk next week about this. Put it on the show notes for next week.
Okay. I certainly will. And I'm sorry you couldn't join us to talk about all of the rest of the week's top entertainment news.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Well, you know, we don't want to make this show as long as, say, off the top of my head, the Oscars. And our show last week went long because we were doing 2 weeks worth of news. So why don't we move along and we can touch on the Spirit Awards. But Michael, I know you just think that the Spirit Awards coming one day before the Oscars, it's kind of an anticlimactic because nobody cares about the Spirit Awards, which are given out for independent films. And I have to say that it's kind of true. Precious swept the Spirit Awards this year, winning director, cast, all the cast members won. One for, I think, screenplay, and it just won everything. And Anne Thompson, who we've mentioned previously in this episode and who appeared last week on the show, she basically said both Eddie Izzard, who hosted, and LA Live, where the event was held downtown in Los Angeles instead of on the beach where it is usually held, both fizzled. Both were not good. One was not a good venue and one was not a good host. Did you see the awards, Michael?
I've never watched them, but it's not that I don't think people don't care, but after the day before the Oscars, people might have spoken about them because they would just happen. But after the Oscars, all the previous award shows are just unimportant. They really should be, they should finish up 2 days before the ballots are due. So they have at least some currency and some validity and some, you know, impetus to exist. It's just the day before the Oscars is silly. You're just in the shadow of the big guy. Why do it? It doesn't make any sense. I guess they want everyone in town. Is that the argument?
That is absolutely correct.
But it's the Spirit Award, so most of the people are not going to the Oscars anyway, or they're not the same. I mean, it just doesn't...
In years past, I would cover both. I would go to the Spirit Awards and then the Oscars. I haven't done that for a couple years, maybe two years. And it was always convenient that they were all in town, but for journalists, it was such a drag because you were working the entire weekend, and by Monday, you were just dead. You were exhausted. And I have to say that very often the people that were at the Oscars the next night were at the Spirit Awards. So it does work out that way.
Well, that's good. So they have a good party, but nobody cares about your show and it gets almost no attention and it has no influence on anything. So well done. You had a good party.
I would agree as far as influence goes. Hold it a week or two before the Academy Awards so that it does have some influence. But, you know, they're not necessarily listening to us, although they did listen to you, Michael, regarding saying the name of the film before the technical winners. I guess, really, we should jump right into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories each week and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story of this week is about, believe it or not, Conan O'Brien, who is going to be doing a live tour, according to Roger Friedman of The Hollywood Reporter.
And I think this is a big deal because it's a brilliant way to keep him in the limelight. It's a brilliant way to show Fox and ABC and other people that he has a big following, big audience. It should be entertaining. He should make money. I assume it'll be a variety show sort of thing with, you know, musical and comedy guests and all that sort of stuff. And he'll be the host. It's a great idea to keep yourself in the headline, in the spotlight. He'll go to L.A., sort of shove it into Jay Leno's face. But I think it would be even more exciting if Leno was sort of floundering in the ratings. But instead, Leno has just seemed to pick up The Tonight Show right where he left off. But still, I think it's a big deal.
Yeah, I guess he's going on a little bit of a road show. It's definitely a big deal. He'll play probably, you know, St. Louis, Chicago, Dallas, New York, Atlanta, you know, all the big cities. Mm-hmm. An interesting side note to this, which has nothing to do with his roadshow. He's finally on Twitter, and his tweets are really funny. He actually says here in one, "Hey gang, look for me at the Oscars tonight. I'll be in the parking lot wearing my prom tux and listening on the radio."
Well, big deal. He has a staff of writers, so, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, this is his way of keeping his comedic wit sharp.
And how many followers does he have on Twitter?
I have something like 1.6. I have no idea. But just to show you how powerful he is, mm-hmm. he is following only one person, Sarah Faith Killen. She is a 19-year-old girl, and I can't even remember where she's in Michigan. And she is going to marry her boyfriend, John, who is 21. And they didn't know how they were going to pull the wedding off. And she had 3 followers. He starts following her. And within 24 hours, she has 12,713 followers. And strangers have practically planned her entire wedding. And someone sent her a new Apple computer. So she's actually benefited greatly from this. And she wasn't sure why he picked her. I just find it a fascinating story. Another fascinating story.
Hold on 1 second. He now has 584,354 followers. I predict now that means Jay Leno will not go online because his audience doesn't even know what Twitter is.
Yeah, that very well may be true. Our next story is about Joaquin Phoenix. You might remember him as the actor turned rapper who is now going to be a rapper turned actor. Turns out he's looking for a good script to make his big comeback. So was the oddball behavior in retirement just a stunt for a faux documentary or indie film? Or was he really going to retire? Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I have to say, he seemed so unhinged, he fooled me. I thought, well, I don't think this is a stunt. I don't think this is an act. I think there's something wrong. But he seems to have just been in character when he was appearing on talk shows and acting weird. So it's a big deal for fooling me, and I'm glad he's back because he's a talented actor.
I agree. It could be a big deal if his career takes off. Our next story is about Hulu, one of my favorite subjects. It turns out Viacom is pulling clips down and the entire shows of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. They're pulling them off of Hulu. And I know, Michael, you believe this seems to be a negotiating tactic more than a permanent decision. ABC, NBC, and Fox, of course, have an ownership stake in Hulu, and this might be their way of saying, hey, give us an ownership stake. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because they're all talking nice, and it's clearly just a negotiating thing, and they're going to come to agreement at some point. This is not them saying, we don't want our stuff on Hulu, we just want it on ComedyCentral.com. But if any good comes out of it, maybe they'll revamp that horrible Comedy Central website and get something that actually works.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is a big deal because you have a lot of people out there who have linked or embedded these clips into their blogs and into their websites. All of those clips will now be broken. One of the big rules about web design and web development is never break your URLs. And in this case, Viacom is breaking that rule. They're breaking all of the URLs that led back to clips of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report on Hulu.
Can't they instantly relink them when they go back on? Or will they have to be all new URLs?
They'll have to be all new URLs.
And really?
Yeah.
They can't just say to put them in the same spot where they were before?
No, I mean, those go through Hulu.
But I know, but when they go back on Hulu, as they will any day now, can't they just reinstate those links?
Oh, yes, they could very easily.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. Our next big deal, big whoop, comes from one of our listeners, Aaron. Who suggested this item for me. A Florida lawmaker in St. Augustine, Florida, has proposed a law to ban tax credits for movies and TV shows filmed in Florida that feature gay characters or gay themes. It sounds a little crazy, but in Florida, they have laws giving tax breaks only to a certain tax break to family-friendly programming, which includes things with like no smoking and stuff like this. And this guy wants to tack on no gay characters because, as we all know, you can't be family friendly if you have a gay character, unless, of course, you are family. But that's a different thing. So is this a big deal or a big whoop? I say it's a big whoop because it's one cranky lawmaker, but it's funny that he should do it and look so silly. Sperling?
I'll say it's a big whoop unless it takes off. If people start to actually buy into this, then it becomes a big deal because I think it's a crock of things I can't actually say on a podcast, on a family-friendly podcast. So I am, as you can imagine, totally dead set against that kind of law. But if others are – if it becomes a political action or a political campaign, then I would believe it's going to be a big deal.
What's the sort of thing that makes him look incredibly outdated and silly and foolish? And so I think it's good that people are sort of reporting it as this wacky, crazy guy, as opposed to 30 years ago when it would have been perfectly reasonable.
Politicians looking wacky or foolish and outdated? It's never happened before. Well, I guess that wraps up our big deal or big whoop for this week. Maybe we move right into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And
all the more appropriate because spring training is in full swing down in the baseball world.
I don't know how that has to do with anything
inside
I'm about to say.
Baseball.
I'm an idiot.
I thought you were joking just then.
No, because I was immediately thinking, you know, Disney Cablevision.
What the hell does that have to do with it?
Exactly. Oh, well, hey, you know
Clearly
what?
Clearly you're not a baseball fan.
No, I'm a huge baseball fan. That's what's ironic about it. You know, I will say I was up quite late last night, and I had planned to get all of these audio clips and, you know, play all of these audio clips during the show, and then I realized, you know what, that's just going to make the show run even longer. And let's face it, most of the people listening to this show saw the Oscars. They don't need me to replay the same speech they heard less than 24 hours ago.
Good call, good call.
Well, this week our Inside Baseball topic is about Disney and Cablevision. Cablevision is, I think, the third or fourth largest cable provider in the United States. It provides cable to a lot of folks in the New York City and Tri-State, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area. And ABC wanted some retransmission rights or retransmission fees for the right to retransmit their signal to Cablevision subscribers. And Cablevision said, heck no, we're not going to do that. Now, this is a story that we've talked about in the past, Time Warner versus Fox. Around New Year's Eve, they, you know, Time Warner was not going to pay Fox a retransmission fee for Fox News or the Fox Network. And here we have the same thing happening again. However, this time, unlike with Time Warner and Fox, Disney did pull ABC for, I think, 21 hours off of Cablevision's network or Cablevision's service.
Yeah, and 14 minutes of the Oscars were cut off from viewers until they finally, you know, agreed to allow the show to go on.
Yes.
So people watching the Oscars had to scramble and make new plans. They went to friends' houses, they watched online, they went to bars with satellite transmission, and then 14 minutes into the show, everybody said, all right, never mind, you can watch the Oscars.
Right, I mean, basically the Oscars was being used as a
bargaining chip.
And I think that if the Oscars were not on ABC, Disney never would have pulled a stunt like this because, you know, if they were on NBC, well, it wouldn't have mattered, frankly. But, you know, Disney owns ABC, so they were able to kind of get away with this kind of activity.
Yeah, it's like having the Super Bowl. I mean, this is one of the biggest telecasts of the year, so it's a big deal. And as we just talked about with Hulu and The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, when these arguments over money come up, it has real repercussions for people in the real world.
That's right. And, you know, ABC started by asking for about $1 per subscriber per month for the local ABC signal to Cablevision subscribers. And according to those in the know, those close to the negotiations, Cablevision said, we're not going to pay that. And even when the target price came down to 60 cents, they still weren't willing to pay it. Who knows where it wound up, but a truce was reached 14 minutes into the Oscars and the signal went back live.
It's a truce, but they haven't actually come to terms yet, right?
Correct, yes.
And to explain to people what's going on and what the changes in the world, you have the network channels like ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. Your local versions of those channels are forced to be carried on cable. Like if you want to be a cable company, you have to agree to carry those local channels.
They're called must carry.
Must carry. And then you have cable channels, original channels like TNT, USA, ESPN, HBO, all these different channels. Well, HBO is even a different category. But all these cable channels are also in existence. They don't have to be carried, but they're very valuable and the cable channels want to carry them. So these channels like ESPN or USA have two revenue streams. One, they have their ads. They sell a lot of money, just like the networks. But two, cable channels like Cablevision, cable companies will pay them to carry them on their thing. They'll give ESPN like 50 cents a subscriber or 70 cents a subscriber for the right to carry ESPN. So ESPN gets two revenue streams, all their ads, plus they get paid by the cable company for being such a valuable channel because the cable company knows people want to watch ESPN. Now, the networks over the years, have grown lower and lower in value. Cable channels are getting bigger and bigger ratings, and they're struggling to survive and pay for all this incredibly valuable programming. The problem is they only have one revenue stream, and those are the ads. And they're finally waking up and saying, you know what? We're really valuable. We want to be paid too. We want money just like ESPN and USA and TNT and MTV and all these other channels. You got to pay us too. And of course, the cable companies are fighting this tooth and nail because they don't want to have to suddenly pony up money. But of course, everyone who watches cable wants those local channels. They want their major networks. So it's a big deal. And there is a possibility someday that one of the networks could go all cable, could stop becoming a local TV channel and just be a cable channel to force them to pay them top dollar for being on their cable network.
Right. And as we speak, the FCC is debating whether to make it not mandatory, but to say that, you know, over the air must carry stations like ABC, NBC, CBS can charge a retransmission fee, and cable operators must pay a retransmission fee to retransmit those local channels through their services. And right now, every 3 years, you know, a network gets to decide, am I a must carry station or not? And if you're must carry, then you can't charge a retransmission fee because a cable operator has to find space for you.
Right. You can't charge it, but you can try and force them into it. You can say, I won't let you carry me, which is what Disney just did. They said that cable has to carry it, but that you have the right to say you can't carry it.
Correct.
So that's where this whole big showdown came. It's all over a lot of money that the big net, you know, what channel do you care about more? Is it ESPN2 or is it ABC? For some people, it's ESPN2. But for a lot of people, the channels they watch the most are ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. And if their cable company doesn't have them, they're going to be furious.
Yes, and part of this, you know, stems from the fact that, as you mentioned, the audience has been fractured. Instead of across three or four networks, it's now fractured over 500 different channels. Ad rates have begun to drop. Therefore, advertising cannot support a must-carry station like an NBC any longer, and those networks are looking for ways to increase their revenue, not necessarily to make a bigger profit, but to at least break even.
And it will affect people because they miss their shows. They miss 14 minutes of the Oscars, or they miss the Daily Show online. So it really impacts people a lot, and it really makes these negotiations very tense and newsworthy. So there'll be a lot. This isn't going to go away anytime soon.
Tense and newsworthy. One, yes. I guess the Oscars were newsworthy, just not tense. And
exactly.
So I'd like to thank Damian Bona for joining us. His book. With the late
Inside Oscar.
Inside, yeah, no, I was you said that his co-author was the late Damien Wiley, but it's Mason
Wiley. Mason Wiley. I beg your pardon.
Yes.
If I misspoke.
Oh, that's okay. It can be found on Amazon. You can find all of the links to stories we talked about on this episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking websites. You can also find a way to email us. Feel free to send us all of your comments to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Alternatively, you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our episodes is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found on MySpace. The URL to look up is myspace.com/MGMT or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, all of Michael Giltz's writing and thoughts and his oeuvre can be found on michaelgiltz.com. He can also be found on Twitter. The username to look up is @MichaelGiltz. Karen Woodward, who had to leave us a little early today, can be found on Twitter. Her username is @Karen_Woodward. She can also be found online. KarenWoodwardOnline.com is the domain to look up. A website you can look up to find some of my writing is CelluloidJunkie.com, and I can be found on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. The show can be found on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.